Yeah, it sure does. I made up some handouts for you. Yeah. Yes. Got them? Okay. So we're going back to the books of King Samuel and Kings. We've been in these books for a couple of years, and we're studying through. We're in 2 Kings right now, right around chapter 8 or so. But because it's been 2 months since we were into the books, I wanted to give us sort of an overview, and go ahead and hand those out to everybody. I wanted to give us sort of an overview of the things that are in those books, so that we can kind of get our minds back to where everything is and what's going on. So I'm going to load a couple of charts up here on the screen. The handouts I am giving you are kind of a condensed version of those timelines, okay? That's not it either. I need a copy too. Thank you. Okay. So you should have two pages, actually. There should be one that says the history of Israel from Exodus to the divided kingdom. And then you're going to have another one that says the kingdom divided. Okay? So you should have two pages. The first page is front and back. There's a little bit on the back of it. But this is a basic breakdown of the... Oh, yeah, you didn't get one? This is a basic breakdown of the information that the Bible gives us in several different places. When we're trying to construct a biblical chronology, you have to take the information just about from all over the place to be able to put it all together. But it works out. God has given us a very good history of the world, starting from the beginning and even going all the way to the very end. So we start with creation in Genesis, and between Genesis 1 and 1 and 2, we get the creation account with the genealogies of chapters 5, 4 and 5. You can put together the next 1,700 years or so up until the flood. And from the flood onward, you can put together all the way from the flood to the time of Christ. And, of course, that's all recorded in the biblical narrative. And then the book of Revelation and some of the other prophetic books like Ezekiel and Isaiah tell us things that are going to be happening in the end times. The mystery that the Bible never revealed much specific about is this period that we live in now, the church age. The church age is specifically called a mystery because prophetic scriptures don't talk about it much. Not much about it was revealed. So there are no prophecies that have to be fulfilled in the church age. Sometimes we look at things that we look at current events and say, well, that's fulfilling prophecy. It's not technically true. There are things that could be leading up to it. But in the church age, technically speaking, we're looking at a time where God hasn't given us any specific prophetic events until we get to the tribulation period. Now, once you get there, yeah, you've got a lot of prophecy throughout the Bible. But as we have been studying through the historical books, we've been looking at the history of the kingdom of Israel, and I think one of the real values of these studies is to see how God interacted with his people. So we see the things that people went through in those times, and while life, society, and culture were somewhat different, the human heart hasn't changed. The things that we experience are still mostly the same, though they might think about them a little bit differently. We still experience much of the same kinds of things in life that they did, and that helps us to see how God is going to interact with us in the things that he gives us. So that's one of the benefits, is we see God interact with David. We can know that God, because of what Kathy said, the God who doesn't change, who interacted with David, is still the same God that interacts with us. We do have to take into account dispensational changes, that there are some things that God does then that he might not do now, but for the most part, we can really be encouraged by the things that we read there, because we can get to know God better. And that's what I think the major benefit of these things is. Now, if you're a history nerd and you just like to study history, then you can just revel in the fact that, hey, there's lots of numbers on here and names and dates. Go ahead, Eldon. Exactly, yes. Yeah, when we watch them do things and say, wow, that was a boneheaded move, but we do the same things, and we should look at the mistakes they made and try to learn from them. So you're absolutely right. Well, to chart our historical course, let's go all the way back to a major event. We could go back to the creation, but that kind of gets outside of the scope of what we wanted to do here. We wanted to build a solid understanding of the nation of Israel. If we're talking about a nation, we're talking about a specific group of people with a law and a land. And that begins at the Exodus. And so we'll begin there. So take out your history of the Kingdom of Israel paper. It has a little paragraph here. I quote the verse from Exodus 19, 5 through 6. It says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." This is the word that God gave to Moses when people were gathered around Mount Sinai. At that point, God has changed Israel from being a connected family to being a nation. He took them out of Egypt, took them to Sinai, gave them a covenant, which was basically a law. It was a constitutional law that would govern them as a people. It was also, we would put it in modern terms, it's kind of like a lease. Israel was entering into a lease with the landowner, and the landowner is Jehovah God. "These are the terms and conditions under which you may continue to use my land." And so as he brings them to Mount Sinai and organizes them as a nation with a organized religious system, they set up the tabernacle, he institutes all the sacrifices and the feast days and the priesthood. All of that gets organized in their first year around Mount Sinai. This really is the birth of a nation and no longer just a very, very large family. So the event, or the year that we give to the Exodus, when you put together all the biblical data, and if you're interested in biblical chronology, it can be kind of confusing, because you'll read different authors who will give you different timelines, and you really have to try to understand the starting point of the author whom you're reading. Because some of the commentators and scholars, even today, start with the standpoint that the biblical data is insufficient and we have to look at other archaeological data to come up with dates. I don't think that's the case. I believe in the sufficiency of Scripture. I believe God has given us accurate information. I don't think we have to recalibrate the biblical calendar to make it fit with what we find from Assyria or from Egypt. Okay. Both of those catalogs, both of those calendars, Assyria and Egypt, can be helpful, but they're also incomplete. And so I like authors who start from the biblical text and work their way out rather than the other direction. Eldon, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I personally took my calculator and reading scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I lost connection.
Okay. When you get to the building of the temple, chronology gets interesting because you start jumping back and forth between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And you actually have different methods of reckoning the calendar in the northern kingdom than you do in the southern kingdom. And sometimes that's why the dates don't line up. This fellow that I use, I have to freely admit that this information comes from a guy named Frank Nolan Lloyd Jones. It's quite a name, huh? But he did his doctoral thesis back in 1994, and this is his doctoral work, was this chronology of Scripture. So he traced out all the data he could find throughout the Bible and put together these charts, wrote a book about it, and that's the one I go with. I can Answers in Genesis sells them. They're very good books. if you're looking for something to help you sleep at night, reading the book can be a good way to induce unconsciousness at times. But if you're really interested in this topic of study, it's a great read. Once again, I've tried to condense it down for you. Sometimes when you get into study Bibles, you will see the year 1446 or 1450 as the year of the Exodus. I don't think that quite fits the biblical data, so I like Jones' date of 1491. And there's some pretty good reasons that go into that, but at any rate. 1491 is the Exodus. Israel comes out of Egypt. They spend about a year camped around Mount Sinai, the one in Midian, not the one in the Sinai Peninsula, right, Eldon? And you guys watched that video in Sunday school a while back, didn't you? About where the Red Sea crossing took place? Oh, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Copyrights are fun things, aren't they? They can, yep. Most of the time when I've contacted somebody and said, hey, I'd like to show this in my church, most of the time that I've had to do that, they've been, well, I'll have to think, maybe about half and half. Sometimes they say, yeah, go ahead. Sometimes they say, sure, you can purchase a license here. But theoretically, I approve of the fact that we should protect somebody's work. Somebody spent a lot of time making those videos, and they should be compensated for their use. That's intellectual property. You do start to feel it a little bit like, now, did you do this for money or did you do this for ministry? But they're not necessarily contrasting ideas. They can be complementary. I mean, after all, you guys don't think that making money is totally against ministry, do you? I'm glad you don't, because you give me a salary to live on while I do my ministry, right? So, at any rate, how do I get off on these things? Yeah, that's right. All right, so 1491, they spend a year around Mount Sinai. They're building the tabernacle, and they're organizing themselves as a people before they move out into the wilderness. We know the events of Kadesh Barnea, where the people refuse to go in and take the land, and so God says, okay, you're going to spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness until everybody in that generation has passed away, and then I'll lead the next generation into the land. So, for 40 years, they wander around the Sinai Peninsula and the area south of Israel, until finally they get to the land in 1451. And you can read about those things in the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy. That's listed up here on our chart. And once again, this is just a graphical representation of what you have in your hand. So, is that somewhat readable? No. All right. I don't know if I can go a whole... I can probably go a little bit bigger. Let's see here. How's that? So the Exodus 1491 B.C., the 2513 A.M. doesn't stand for morning. It stands for Anno Mundo, I think it is. So year of the world. That's dating from creation. So Moses spends 40 years wandering around with the people until 1452, when he passes away. Israel enters the land with Joshua, and they begin a seven-year war to conquer the promised land. And so those events can be read about in Joshua 1 through 5, or the war is, the wars take place Joshua 1 through 5. And then conquering the land and dividing up the land at the end of those 7 years. So in 1444, we find Israel in possession of the land. They've divvied it up among the tribes, and they begin the process of completely subduing the land, which they never finish, by the way. They never completely kick out the inhabitants of the land. The Canaanites, the Philistines, the Amorites, they all continue to dwell in the land, and it's a constant problem for Israel. Becomes a picture. How many of you have heard songs that compare crossing the Jordan to death for the Christian? And entering Canaan is supposed to be like heaven. Ever hear songs like this? Okay. Boy, I certainly hope that that's not actually the case, because when I get to heaven, I don't want to find any enemies there. Right? Crossing the Jordan was not a picture of death. It's a picture of faith. It's a picture of the moment of trusting God. And conquering the land is not a picture of dwelling in heaven. It's a picture of the Christian life, which is a constant war. It's a war between what is spiritual within us and what's fleshly within us. And so we're constantly fighting off those enemies. Well, there is a 44 or so year gap between the time that the land is conquered and the beginning of the period of the judges. And we can piece that together from some other data there. But Joshua dies in 1424. He's 110 years old. And the nation continues to follow the Lord from that point and up until the rulers or the elders who ruled with Joshua passed away. Joshua specifically tells us that during that time period, Israel obeyed the Lord and did what his covenant commanded. And so right around 1405, and that's an approximate date, right around 1405, they stop following the covenant. And then in 1400 or so, the period of the judges begins. The book of Judges is the story of constant revivals and backfallings, and revival and backfalling. So the nation would fall into idolatry or some form of disobedience, and some of them were local, some of them were national. And then God would send in a nation to oppress them and put them into slavery until they would cry out to God for help, and he would send a judge who would begin a military campaign and deliver Israel from the hand of her enemies. That period goes on for about 300 years, the period of the judges. One way that we know that is one of the judges named Jephthah. The Moabites invade the land and start saying, hey, when you Israelites came into the land, you took our land and we want it back. And Jephthah gives them this speech and makes a couple of contending points and says, number one, we didn't take your land. God didn't let us take Moab. And number two, we've been living here for 300 years and you never said a thing. So, what is it, finders, keepers? No. So he gives us this timeline. 300 years we've been dwelling in the land. So that lets us know about how long it's been. So if we pass over the period of the judges, and we'll go very quickly from 1400 BC to about 1160, and we have the judges of Othniel, we have, we have Ehud, the left-handed judge, we have Deborah and Barak, we have Gideon, we have Abimelech, we have Tola, we have Jer, we have Jephthah, whom I just mentioned. We have Samson, who overlaps some of the judges. And ironically, Samson also overlaps another key figure that pertains directly to our study, and that is Samuel. Where'd he go? There he is. Samuel is born pretty close to the same time as Samson is born. And so there is some overlap there between what happens in the book of Judges and what happens in the books of Samuel. So, in 1220 BC, Eli is born. He's at 30 years old. He would become the high priest. And then he is high priest up until Samuel is born. And this gets us into the study of the books of Samuel, because Hannah was barren. She wanted a child. She went to the tabernacle and she prayed to the Lord that he would open her womb and give her a child. Eli, the high priest, thinks she's drunk, rebukes her. She says, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm praying. I'm just pouring out my heart to God. And he says, oh, okay, well, if that's the case, then I hope the Lord grants your request. The Lord does grant her request, and she gives birth to Samuel. She delivers him to Eli just a couple of years later, and Samuel is raised at the tabernacle. And he's of priestly descent, so he functions as a priest until God calls out to him, and he becomes a prophet. We get sort of a summary view of all of those things in Samuel's life. So this middle line here is Samuel's line. We can see things going on down there with Samson. But during this time, Israel is being oppressed by Philistines. The Philistines, who live down by the Mediterranean Sea, have come up into the mountainous regions of Israel and have oppressed the people, so much so that they won't even allow anyone in Israel to become a blacksmith. Because if you're a blacksmith, what do you know how to work with? Metals, right? And what do you make out of metals? Weapons. And so Israel couldn't even take care of their own farm implements like plows and pruning hooks. They had to take them down to the Mediterranean coast and have the Philistines do the work, because nobody was allowed to be a metal worker in Israel, lest Israel start making weapons. Should I make some vague reference to taking away Second Amendment rights, or should I leave that one go? So, that's all happening while Samuel is a priest. While Samuel is a priest also, there's another fellow stirring up trouble with the Philistines, and his name is Samson. And he is ripping the gates off of cities and carrying them for 20 miles. He's tying foxtails together and burning up acres and acres of prime farmland. Has that ever happened to your farmland, Eldon? Nobody ever burned it up with foxes? Not fire? No, probably some wind damage and hail damage, though. Once in a while. Well, Samson was pretty creative when it came to destroying the Philistines' things, all right? In 1122, right here, we have a very important event, and it's described in 1 Samuel 4, chapters 4 through 7. And the Israelites go out to battle the Philistines at the town of Aphek. And they lose the initial battle, so they bring the Ark of the Covenant to the battlefront, thinking that, hey, if the Ark's here, then God will be with us and we'll win. They lose because God was teaching them a lesson. You're not trusting me. You think this thing made out of Ark and gold is the same as me, and that's not true. That's just like idolatry. Anytime we start to equate God with something created, it's idolatry. And so they weren't living up to the terms of the covenant. In fact, so much so that we're told that Eli's sons, who were priests at the time, and Eli knew this, and Eli was doing nothing about it, but his sons were corrupt, wicked men, and they were stealing sacrificial animals. They were engaging in inappropriate relationships with the girls serving at the tabernacle, and the news of this was all throughout Israel, but Eli refused to do anything about it. And so God intervened to teach his people a lesson. And while they're rising up to try to break the Philistine dominion, God institutes it even more so. Because at Aphek, not only is Israel defeated, but the Ark is captured and taken to Philistine territory. And we studied these things in 1 Samuel 4 through 7. Well, the Ark is in Philistine territory for 7 months, but when Eli heard that, number one, the Ark was captured, and that, number two, both of his sons died in the battle, he fell over backwards, broke his neck because he was a very large man, and the nation of Israel was left without a high priest because there was nobody at that point qualified to take the position. His son's son was very, very young, and you couldn't take the high priest position until you're 30 years old. Well, that left a vacuum in the nation that Samuel filled. He wasn't high priest because he couldn't take it. He wasn't of the right family, but he was a priest. And so he begins a ministry of traveling around the nation, prophesying, teaching the word of God to people, and generally trying to lead them back to a revival. Well, that goes on until 1101 B.C. And in 1101 B.C., goes on until 1095 B.C. So in 1095 B.C., after some battles and things that Samuel led the people in 1095, the people finally come to Samuel and say, you know what, you're getting old. And we're kind of tired of this whole judges setup. because we never know who's going to be our next leader. And things haven't really gone well for us with a judge. We want a king. Well, God gives them a king, and it's Saul. And so in 1 Samuel 8 to 12, we read about the accounts of Saul being anointed the first king of all Israel, and he reigns for 40 years. We don't know how old he was when he became king, but we know he reigned for 40 years, and we know that his son was old enough to be commander of the army, which meant at least 20. So Saul, at the beginning of his rule, has at least a 20-year-old son, probably older than that. In all likelihood, Jonathan is somewhere around 28 years older than David. Gives us an interesting perspective. When Jonathan and David become friends, it's not because they were peers of the same age. All right? It was like a father-son kind of relationship, where Jonathan is looking at David like, you're the son, you're the next heir to the throne, and I recognize that. So it's a really interesting story. So David is born somewhere around 1085 BC. We don't know exactly how old he is when he kills Goliath. But we know he's not old enough to join the army yet, because when he goes to the battle, he's just delivering food to his brothers. If he were 20 years old, he would have been in the army. But he's also old enough to be called a mighty man of valor. So here we have this guy that's got to be at least mostly grown. He's old enough to fight lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. You knew it was coming, didn't you? He's old enough to fight off those animals and kill them, but he's not old enough to be in the army. So we're probably looking at somewhere when he's around 16, 17 years old, he's anointed king, and then he slays Goliath. Maybe 18 years old, okay? That event begins a term of service with Saul, where he starts to become commander of the military, very young. So when he starts commanding troops, he's got to be just about 20 years old, very, very young. But that only goes on for a couple of years, and then Saul begins to get very, very jealous of David, tries to kill him a couple of times, and then David runs. He goes into hiding for about 10 years. So sometime around 1067 or 1065, we have David going off into his wanderings, and that lasts for 10 years. Until 1055, Saul dies in battle with the Philistines on Mount Gilboa. He's killed, his son Jonathan is killed, and Judah comes along and says, David, you're the guy, we want you to be king. The northern tribes anoint Ishbosheth, Saul's other son, king. And for about 7 years, there is a bit of civil war going on between the northern tribes under Ishbosheth and Judah with David. But in 1048, 7.5 years, David becomes king of the entire nation, and he unifies Israel into one monarchy once again. That ruling lasts for 33 years. David reigns for a total of 40 years. And so that helps us put together some other timing. So we get to the back of our sheet there. From 1048 to about 1037, remember when you're BC, you count down. When you're after Christ, we count up. So that period is David's wars. He fights off the Moabites. He fights off the Edomites. He fights off a Syrian conglomerate. He fights many, many wars in that short period of time. But those wars have the effect of securing Israel, of making sure that she's no longer threatened by the nations around her. And this hasn't been the case since they entered the land. The whole period of the judges, and even into Saul's reign, saw Israel constantly being threatened by enemies. And it was only under David that Israel was secured as a nation. It was that same reason that God said, no, you're not going to build me a temple because you're a man of blood. You're a man that I use to fight war. It's not your purpose. And so David, though he wanted to build the temple, was told no, he's not allowed to build the temple. But sometime around 1035... we have David not going to war with his troops like he should have. Instead, he stays behind at Jerusalem, and one night while he's getting some fresh air, he happens to notice that down on one of the other rooftops is a woman bathing. He calls her to his palace. He commits adultery with her. She was not unknown to him. Sometimes we get it in the story that like this was just some random girl. But Uriah, her husband, was one of David's 30 mighty men. You can be sure that David knew Uriah very, very well. And that when he heard this was Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, it's not like she was somebody that was completely unknown to him. Okay, so that makes the treachery all that much worse. But David, sometime around 1037, commits adultery with Bathsheba and has Uriah murdered. That baby dies, but then in 1035, Solomon is born, sometime around 1035. We're never actually told how old Solomon is when he takes the throne. We're just told that he's young and inexperienced. We're also told that he has a young son at the time. Rehoboam is 41 years old when he takes the throne. Solomon reigned for 40 years, so that tells us that when Solomon took the throne, Rehoboam was a year old. So he has a young son when he starts. But David dies in 1015 after 40 years on the throne. Solomon takes the throne, and Solomon rules for, any guesses? 40. Yeah, the first three kings of Israel all rule the same length of time. 40 years, 40 years, 40 years. It's a nice little parallel. So Solomon rules for 40 years, but a major important event is recorded in 1 Kings chapter 4, and it's the beginning of the temple. One of the reasons, well, there's many reasons that's a majorly important event in the biblical narrative, the beginning of the temple. But one of the interesting things as it relates to chronology is that we're specifically told that that Solomon laid the foundation of the temple in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of Egypt. Okay? 480th year. So that helps us synchronize all of this stuff. That verse there in 1 Kings 4 lets us know that in 1012 BC is exactly 480 years after the Exodus. So how do we place the Exodus at 1491? We go 480 years before the building of the temple, or beginning building the temple. So that also tells us, some scholars will say that the book of Judges is a very convoluted time and we can't get the date down exactly. Well, that's simply not true. The Bible gives us a very good exact date that from the Exodus to the founding of the temple is 480 years. So we can piece together what's in there a little more certainly. And if we know that the temple was built in the fourth year of Solomon, okay, we go back 3 years to the time Solomon became king, 40 years for David, 40 more years for Saul, that even puts the gap a little bit narrower. So now we're not talking about 480 years, we're talking about 397 years is the only amount of time that we have to piece together in the period of the judges. And so it's not as hopeless as some scholars like to make it think, if you believe that the Bible tells us the truth and is accurate when it tells us the truth. Okay. So that brings us to 1012 BC and the founding of the temple. Very, very, very big event. Well, Solomon begins that, but in 975, after a very prosperous reign, but also at the end a very detrimental reign as Solomon begins to seek after the gods of the nations around Israel, and he begins leading the nation into idolatry. So these first 20 years of Solomon's reign bring us to the climax of Israelite kingdom history. This is as good as it's ever been, and until the Messiah comes, it's as good as it's ever going to get, right, under Solomon. That is, if David is a picture of a secure kingdom, Solomon is a picture of a prosperous kingdom. And that's what God accomplishes through those two men. Both of those things will be united under the Messiah when Jesus rules. It will be both a secure nation and a prosperous nation all at one time. But Solomon began to undo his own work, because as he began to marry many foreign women, we're told he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, or is that reverse? Anyway, he had a lot of gals, and that turned his heart away from following the Lord. And so by the time that he dies in 975 BC, things have gotten to a really bad state. Jerusalem is now filled not with a temple to Jehovah, but it's filled with many altars to foreign gods, because he would build them for his wives as anniversary presents. Guys, you ever give your wife an altar as an anniversary gift? Don't start, all right? Eldon. Kitchen sink, that's a good one, yep. Mm-hmm. I was told years ago, don't ever, and Kim's listening, so she's going to giggle at this, but I was told, don't buy your wife appliances for birthdays and anniversaries because that smacks too much of work, right? Like I'm asking her to do more work. But then one day Kim told me, and I had to realize this, that it's like saying don't buy me a tool for my birthday or anniversary. And she says, I love new tools because cooking and kitchen work really is one of Kim's art forms. She loves it. And so buying her new appliances and things is like buying her a brand new power saw. And so that helped me say, oh, okay. So sorry, hun, for years I avoided those things because I thought it'd be a bad idea. But at any rate, how do I get off on this stuff?
Altars?
What does an altar have to do with blenders? Huh? Oh, wives. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, okay. Anyway, that brings us up to the end of Solomon's reign in 975 BC, which also brings us to the last point when the kingdom was united as one kingdom. Because when Rehoboam becomes king, he makes an incredibly foolish decision. The whole nation comes to him and says, Rehoboam, the taxes are far too high. Your dad was killing us with the level of taxation to keep all his building projects going. You know where government gets money, right? Mm-hmm. From its people. Government doesn't actually produce anything. It has to tax people to get its money. All right? It's not like, I don't know, you could look at it and say, well, they charge taxes so that you can use the roads. That's true, but I don't have much of an option in that, right? If I go to Walmart, I have an option if I want to buy that TV or not buy that TV. I don't have too much of an option to not use the roads. But at any rate, Solomon's building projects had to be financed somehow. And I always love when they do like man on the street interviews and ask, you know, should the government provide this? Oh, yeah, the government should provide that. Where should they get the money? Oh, I don't know. It's the government. They have an endless supply of money, right? He said, no, they don't have an endless supply of money. They have to tax us to get their money. So the people came to Rehoboam and said, please, for goodness sakes, lower the taxes. You're killing us. And Rehoboam's response was, because he listened to the young guys he grew up with, he didn't listen to the older folks that were good counselors. He said, you know what? My little finger will be thicker than my father's thighs, saying, I'm going to make it worse. You think you were taxed bad under my father? Just wait until I get a hold of that IRS, and then you'll see what taxation's all about. Well, the people said, forget that. We're splitting. And so the country split in two. And the northern tribes, Ephraim and Naphtali and all of those tribes up in the north, they sided with a fellow named Jeroboam the First, who actually used to work for Solomon. I think he was a sheep herder for Solomon. Well, they anointed Jeroboam as the first king of the northern kingdom. And the southern tribe of Judah and Simeon, they still sided with Rehoboam. So David's house is still in charge in the south because God made David a promise. You can bet if God had not made David a promise that one of his sons would always sit on the throne of Israel, that the people would have cast Rehoboam off in a heartbeat. But God was at work to make sure that his purposes were accomplished. And so Rehoboam remains king in the southern kingdom. Rehoboam, and this is where Eldon was talking about getting into difficulty trying to trace the timeline. Because from here on out, the chronicler of 1 Kings has to go back and forth for us. He has to trace what happens in the northern kingdom, and then he's going to trace what happens in the southern kingdom. And so sometimes you're advancing in the northern kingdom, and then you've got to back up and catch up the southern kingdom. And it is a crazy back and forth. You will notice on this chart, and this is one of the reasons I like this fellow Jones, he lists out both the northern and the southern kingdom start with their kings in 975 BC. Jeroboam begins his first year, and Rehoboam begins his first year. This is where we start to see that there is a little bit of a difference in how the northern kingdom accounted its years and how the southern kingdom accounted its years. The southern kingdom used what's called ascension year reckoning, meaning that, if you see this little AC here, that means that's the year that Rehoboam ascended the throne. That was also the year that Solomon died. And so when the south accounts time, Solomon gets credited for that year, even if he only ruled part of that year. But he died that year, so that's counted as Solomon's year, even though Rehoboam took charge of the kingdom that year. Rehoboam's first year will be the first year that he rules on his own, not the year that he shared with his dad. Does that make sense? And so 976 gets counted to Solomon, not to Rehoboam, even though Rehoboam took the throne this year. So his first year is 975. If you'll notice up here, especially where you have an overchange of the kings, Nadab takes over from Jeroboam in Jeroboam's 22nd year. But that 22nd year is also counted as Nadab's first year. So that 1 year is getting counted twice. And this is where, if you look at the northern kingdoms and you try to line up all of their times as kings, you'll get a different number of years than if you do the southern kingdom. And that's because you have to realize that there is an overlap. That first year of a king in the northern kingdom is also counted as the last year of the king before him. And so you have to account for that in order to make things work out right. Jeroboam reigns for 22 years. Rehoboam only reigns for 17. After Rehoboam reigns, we have his son Abijah and then his grandson Asa. In the north, Jeroboam's son Nadab takes the throne, but he only rules for 2 years and he's assassinated by Baasha. Baasha takes the throne and rules for 24 years. And so his rule overlaps with Asa in the southern kingdom, who rules for 41 years. If you want, I'll have to tell you where this book is at, but it's really interesting to just sit down and look at these charts. They're fascinating, okay? But you'll notice another thing that's going on is in the southern kingdom, there's still only one dynasty. We have a clear succession of kings, all descended from David, until Jesus Christ. A clear line of kings. But that does not happen in the northern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, right here, Nadab is assassinated by Baasha, and you have the institution of their second dynasty. Baasha rules for 24 years, and then his son Elah takes the throne. Elah is assassinated by a guy named Zimri, who rules for 7 days. Zimri is taken out by Omri. And then there's a civil war for 7 years between Omri and Tibni. And then Omri takes over. And then Omri's dynasty lasts for quite a while. Omri's son is a notorious fella named Ahab, one of the most wicked kings ever to sit on the throne of Israel, especially because he had help. He truly had a one-flesh relationship with his wife, and they worked together pretty hard to make sure that idol worship was introduced severely in the northern kingdom, Jezebel. Well, their son, Ahaziah, only rules for 2 years, and then he dies because he falls off the roof. And so once he dies, his son Joram, or Jehoram, takes over. Jehoshaphat is king in the southern kingdom. And this is right about where we're going to pick up in 1 Kings chapter 8. We are in the reign of Joram, and we're in the reign of Jehoram in the south. Don't get those two confused. They're not the same guy, even though their name is very much the same. But there's also a reason that their name is the same, because Jehoshaphat was really good friends with Ahab. He went on many battles with him. He helped him out. He helped out Ahaziah. And he also gave his son Jehoram as a wife the daughter of Jezebel. So you can see how this is probably going to turn out. Jezebel, this wicked queen, who loves to worship things like Molech, the god of the of the Amorites, or the Ammonites, or the Moabites. Or the mosquito bites, I forget. Okay. Any rate, a lot of idolatry going on here. Jehoshaphat was a righteous king, but we're going to see something terrible happen with his son Jehoram, and even an interregnum period right here. Because this girl, Athaliah, this is not a guy, this is Queen Athaliah. She is the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. This is Jehoram's wife. When Jehoram dies, Athaliah takes over rulership and, what is that word? She has a coup. She kills off all of the royal descendants except one that she can't find. And she makes herself queen. And she rules over Israel for 7 years. And then the priests realize this is not the situation God intended. God promised Davidic kings to rule over Israel. And so they find the one last Davidic heir, which is Joash, and they make him king. And they have to have a big fight, but we'll get there. Right here, Jehu is a new dynasty. He's going to be used as an instrument by God to wipe out Ahab's dynasty. And so this is where we're going to pick up, is right in the middle of all this kind of craziness going on. The stability of the kingdoms is gone. Everything's going to constantly be changing. And it's going to be noted for us time and time again that it is because Israel didn't follow what God said. They weren't living up to the terms of the covenant, that lease by which God granted use of the land. So, that catches us up historically. I know that's a lot of information. Hopefully the charts will help you if you want to go look at that stuff later on and kind of review things. Any questions about what we're covering? Kathy? Yes, she does. Well, she's thrown out the window.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They might have. You know, the people in the Northern Kingdom were not opposed to doing things like that to their rulers to get rid of them. Yeah. It was a really bad situation in time. Eldon. Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, as they were washing out the chariot, the dogs are licking up the blood. And the same thing is prophesied about Jezebel, that where the dogs licked up the blood of Ahab, they'll lick up the blood of Jezebel as well. So when Jehu comes through and wipes out Ahab's dynasty and Jezebel is killed, he commands her body to be thrown in that same place so that it can happen. And it does. Gruesome story, because I think it says that, you know, they throw her out there and then Jehu goes in and eats dinner, and when he comes back, there's nothing left but hands and a skull. All right? So, lovely, lovely stuff. And boy, don't ever think that the Bible presents this pristine view of history that's all neat and clean. The effects of sin and the curse are written everywhere in the pages of the Bible. So, any other questions or comments? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And the histories that are given to us in the pages of the Bible are written in more of a topical fashion than they are chronological, right? And so the historian will write about Ahab. Ahab starts ruling 3 years before Jehoshaphat. So we'll get a very full description of Ahab's reign until he dies, and then the writer will come back and talk about Jehoshaphat. Well, as you can see from this visual, yeah, this one right here on my screen, you can see from this visual that there's a lot of overlap. A lot of what happens in Ahab's reign affects Jehoshaphat and vice versa, but the way the writer narrates it for us, he goes up and he follows Ahab all the way until Ahab dies, and then he comes back and picks up with Jehoshaphat and carries through Jehoshaphat. Eldon.
A lot of historians try to compare
Mm-hmm. And, except they had it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look at, so here's the situation. A lot of ancient world history is built on the work of a priest from Egypt named Manetho. Not a biblical priest. He was a priest of the Egyptian gods. And his name was Manetho, and he put together a history of Egypt describing the dynasties of Egypt. And if you place those end to end, you can go back about 4,000 years. And historians say, ooh, this is great. We have a very complete history of Egypt from Manetho. But is there a biblical problem with going back 4,000 years in history? What happened 2,500 years before Christ? The flood. The flood wipes out the world before that. There is no record other than the biblical one of what happened in the world before that event. Right? So you can't have any records of history going back before 2,500 BC. And even that, you have to have the Tower of Babel, which was probably 150 years after the flood. So you don't have this dividing up into nations until about 2,200, 2,300 BC. Well, the problem with Manetho was exactly what Eldon said. For many, many years, we didn't realize that when Manetho was describing dynasties, many of them overlapped each other by quite a bit. And the Egyptians were very good at going back and erasing the histories of people they didn't like. Tearing down monuments of people that we think are not good characters. Sound familiar? Right? So everybody they disagreed with, sometimes they try to erase them from history. Well, we try to piece that together, and it's just, it doesn't work. But when God gives us an uninterrupted history of his people from beginning to end, that's what helps us piece it all together. All right, anything else? Sorry, I'm carrying us over here. It's 7 after. Yeah. All right. Okay. If you have any questions, feel free to let me know what they are, and I can try to muddy the water for you. All right.